I sort of feel like I felt when I was a kid and went to summer camp. It's far away from my usual responsibilities, different bunch of people. At the end of summer camp, you'd all get all dressed up so you could go to town. So I'm all dressed up to go to town. I'm finished after this lecture, and I've had a good time with you guys. We're going to talk about two-dimensional critical phenomena and the work that was started by Polyakov and then done by him and lots of other people on what is called conformal field theory. I've lectured on everything else in this course a bunch of times. This material I basically learned to deliver lectures here, so I'm going to be a little less fluent, perhaps, than in some of the other things. According to the extended singularity theorem, the symmetries of infinite uniform space are crucial for understanding critical phenomena. The problem is not so much what, at least in two dimensions, what space is like. Space is sort of simple and boring. Question is, what can happen to that space? We don't really know very well the answer to that question in three dimensions or four, but we have a good start at knowing kinds of things that happen to the space in two dimensions. This because two-dimensional space has a rich symmetry structure, which we can, in some measure, understand. This symmetry structure is connected with the structure of the theory of complex variables. Well, I'll tell you about that. The question is, what is the symmetry what is the structure of the space in the presence of the fluctuating operators that occur at the critical point of various phase transitions? What I'm going to be talking about today is almost entirely at the critical point. There are no correlation lengths, there's no magnetic field, there's no deviation from criticality. Each different kind of operator, O alpha of R, produces at the point R a sort of singularity, maybe a puncture in the space, and that singularity is different depending on which operator it is. So we're going to look for the symmetries in the simplest correlation functions in the simplest models. I'll focus on the Ising model because I understand that best, at the critical point involving the simplest quantum spin, energy density, and stress tensor density operators. These are best expressed in terms of a pair of complex coordinates. Go, fella. Supposed to go. Okay. Yeah, not everything's working. It's okay. We started, you recall, talking about the operator product expansion last time. This is the statement that if you take any two fluctuating operators, multiply them by one another, because there's nothing in the theory but the standard fluctuating operators, what comes out must be a sum of the standard fluctuating operators. That's what happens here on line three of this. Oh, probably I didn't turn it on properly. Now, if I can only remember how to turn it on. Yeah. On-off switches are great things. Okay. Wrong place, but that's okay. That's easily fixed. Go back and make sure I'm in the right place. Okay. Once you replace the product by a sum of the standard fluctuating operators, that's because there isn't anything else but the standard fluctuating operators. If you recall what was written last time, the product was given in terms of a sum of operators at the point halfway in between R and S. The more modern way of writing things, which is not the way I originally introduced, is to give the sum at S. That gives a much more elegant theory. This provides a sort of algebra for the fluctuating operators in the theory. even before Wilson's work on the renormalization group, it was hoped by mostly by Polyakov and myself that algebraic methods would enable a classification of and perhaps an analytic solution for two-dimensional critical phenomena. People have achieved that, in particular Friedan, Q, and Shanker have achieved that using algebraic methods based on what is called conformal invariance. I'll explain to you what conformal invariance is in a moment. Are going forward properly? Excuse me for being confused. The best way to represent the symmetries in space in two dimensions is to use, instead of the spatial variable x, y, a pair of complex variables. Z is x plus iy, and z star is x minus iy. In almost the entire literature, the notation is not z star, but z bar. However, Apple's keynote doesn't prevent over bars very easily, and so I'm going to use the more old-fashioned notation using a star. Spin operator is written as sigma of z, z star. Energy density is epsilon of z, z star. The two complex coordinates are treated as independently of one another. Therefore, if we're taking, for example, a derivative with respect to the x coordinate, that's also a derivative with respect to z plus a derivative with respect to z star. We make considerable use of analytic functions of z, which are called holomorphic functions, and similar functions of z star called anti-holomorphic functions. In fact, we mostly look at z dependence and ignore z star. Generic operator is O alpha of z, z star. We'll focus on the two operators, sigma of z, z star, and energy density of z, z star. In addition, we'll devote considerable attention to the stress tensor, which later on I make sure I write as small t of j sub k. The stress tensor describes the structure of the space and describes how we change the structure of that space. It is crucial in all stuff that has to do with conformal symmetry. The usual notation now is to give the x sub alpha, which describes the scaling index for the operator O alpha, as h sub alpha plus h star sub alpha. H sub alpha is a scaling index referring to z. H star sub alpha is a scaling index referring to z star. And these operators, which are scalars, have h alpha equal h star. Question, please.
X equals z plus z star over 2. Shouldn't there be some factors of 1/2 in this definition?
I have a right to choose what I want. In fact, I chose x. Some other guys chose h. But they have a right too, and they chose it that way. So, for the, let me remember what's going on. For the sigma operator, x is 1/8, and h is 1/16. I only invented half of it, so don't blame me. Christie and Henkel use a slightly different notation. That's one of the books out there in which h is written as delta. That's just as good as this notation. Symmetries are reflected in the correlations. Sigma z z star is the magnetization. Epsilon z z star is the energy density. And a correlation function of sigma with sigma at two different positions are written as you see in line 3 here. Find my stick. So sigma correlated between this point and this point is the distance between the points magnitudes raised to 1/4 power and is the 1/8 power of the complex distance, and the one times the 1/8 power of the conjugate distance with complex conjugates. The 1 here sets the normalization of the correlation function, and these correlation functions are normally chosen to have a leading coefficient of 1. The energy density is the same thing with z minus w squared. It turns out that the energy density and the spin have zero correlator. It needn't have turned out that way from just scaling properties, but that's what happens. However, the three-point function has this particular structure. If we take epsilon at z, sigma at w, sigma at t, then you get w minus t to the 3/4 power divided by the magnitude of z minus w, first power z minus t to the first power. This satisfies all the scaling results we know about, as well as rotational invariance. The correlations written here apply in a continuum limit at which we look at distances large enough so lattice structure has disappeared. In this limit, our usual Ising model has translational invariance and rotational invariance at the critical point. Thus, the correlation functions are unchanged if we replace each coordinate according to, that equation looks crazy, so I'll rewrite it, z goes into z plus a, where a is a complex number. That is translation. Of course, it is also true that z star goes into z star plus a star. That is goes along with that. And then rotational invariance is z goes into z prime, which is equal to lambda times z with the magnitude of lambda equal to 1. This way of representing rotational invariance is extremely convenient, is one of the basic reasons why we use complex variables. The operators vary then by having the O's go into O's depending on Z to go into the O's that depend on Z prime. We could further extend this analysis to include scale invariance. Scale invariance is you change the size of the coordinate. That can be done by letting z prime equal lambda z. That's a new coordinate is lambda times the old coordinate. That lambda now has a magnitude different from unity. Rotation has the magnitude of lambda equal to 1. Scale transformations have the magnitude of lambda different from 1. Then the operators will change according to O alpha of zz prime becomes lambda to the h alpha times lambda star, the complex conjugate of lambda, to the power h star sub alpha, times O alpha of z prime and z prime star. This is the transformation. This is roughly the transformation law that we'll be looking at throughout this lecture. So far, all we have is a rather neat representation of the well-known symmetries of the critical phenomena problem. I'm about to pop into something new, I think. In two dimensions, we can study the effects of analytic functions. In two dimensions, we can study the effect of maps constructed from analytic functions upon correlation functions. In general, a transformation z goes into w. W is like what I called z prime before, which is some function of z. Maps a portion of the space defined by the z-plane into some portion of the space defined by the w. This transformation provides no local shears. Shears, you pull that way and that way. There's no local shear, except at points of non-analyticity. Local angles are preserved at all points of analyticity. That is, if you have in the z-plane a triangle which looks like this, with angles that look like that, in the w-plane, the triangle may have a different size. It may be positioned in a different way, but it will have the same basic angles in it.
The symmetries you talked about in the previous slides, are they, like, you talked about them at the critical point, are they, they're always there, though, right?
Let me back up. We've got a lattice underneath. Stop backing up, excuse me. Back up 1, 2. We've got a lattice underneath all this. If the lattice is important, then there's nothing like rotational symmetry. And if you go translate through half a lattice constant, you get something which is funny. We're at the critical point, or in the critical region. The lattice has stopped being important. Now, your question might be, if you have a long correlation length, has the lattice stopped being important? Yes is the answer. So that we should be talking to some extent about rotational scaling and translational symmetry in the whole region around the critical point. However, I'm about to do something called conformal invariance, which applies only at the critical point. And so most of what goes on in this lecture applies only at the critical point. In two dimensions, we can study the effects of analytic function maps upon the problem. For example, I could let W equal z squared or z cubed or e to the alpha times z or any of a whole variety of functions. These are all analytic functions except at special points. The special points in all of these cases are z equals infinity. They are perfectly smooth analytic functions for every other point but z equals infinity. There's a theorem, as you recall, in complex analysis that the only function which has no singularities is the constant. And so every function you have to look for singularities. This kind of transformation in which you change the operator into the operator that depends on a new coordinate, and the new coordinate may be defined, as I have there, as a very funny function of z, and then a multiply by coefficients which depend on the new coordinate. B of w is dw dz to the h alpha, B of W star is dw dz star to the power h alpha star. I should logically have a star here and a star there, but I don't. This is particularly simple for the global transformations described so far. It's trivial for the translation, B is 1. Easy for W equals lambda z, B is just a power of lambda. If, in fact, it is if lambda is real, so we're not doing any rotation, the change is called a dilation. A dilation means an expansion or contraction, together with a rotation, if lambda is not real, through the phase of lambda. The analogous calculation for any other analytic function requires additional thought. No other function can smoothly, that is analytically, map the plane into itself. So any function besides the functions that are mentioned here will change the region under consideration in your analysis of the system. The cases I just gave there have a special behavior at the point at infinity, but you can have special behaviors any place. Transformations produced by analytic functions are called conformal transformations. They were introduced into critical phenomena work in 1970 by Polyakov. I think actually he did it somewhat earlier. John Carney, who I am replacing and giving this series of lectures,
showed us how to make use of specific transformations like the one in the next slide. Here is one kind of transformation. This is the backward version of it. Imagine that we do W is L over 2 pi. L is a number like 7, but it's thought of as a length, times logarithm of z. That then implies z is the exponential of 2 pi W over L. That's just the inverse of that transformation. This function is analytic at z, except that z equals 0 and z equals infinity. Sorry, the infinity isn't down on the slide. This function takes the entire complex plane, except for the points at 0 and infinity, into a strip in the complex W plane, which obeys the imaginary part of W less than or equal to L over 2. L I consider to be real, and so we get the whole plane going into a strip in W. Maybe I should draw it. So the whole two-dimensional world goes into a strip of width L in W. We can then use the rule in the last slide to calculate the correlations as they arise in the W plane. O alpha of W, W star times O alpha of U and U star is 1 over Z minus Y to the 2H, Z star minus Y star to the 2H, Z, Z star, Y, Y star raised to the power H. That's the general, that's the result of doing the derivatives on this exponential function, H being the property of the operator O alpha. After a little bit more algebra, give it here, and equally in your notes, what comes out is a correlation function in W and W star, which looks like that. Now, the original correlation function had a singularity in it when z was equal to y. U is to y as w is to z. That is, y is the exponential of 2 pi u over l. The correlation function turns out to be this, and let me draw you a picture of it. There is a singularity right here in W when W equals U in the strip. In fact, let me draw it slightly off the center of the strip because it will enable me to make my point better. So there's a singularity there. What we have in effect is periodic boundary conditions with strips repeated again and again and again. And in fact, this structure with cosines means that in each one of these repeated strips, we have the same singularity. However, we're only focusing on W in here, and then we only have this one singularity. What we have done by this mapping is convert a problem in the entire complex plane into a problem in a strip of in the complex plane with periodic boundary conditions. Conformal invariance enables you to do something that we who founded the subject of studying critical phenomena never thought you could do. It enables you to solve in sort of any geometry you want by doing the appropriate conformal transformation. If I can calculate a 9-point correlation function in the entire complex plane, I can calculate it in a strip geometry or in something that looks like an amoeba. by doing the appropriate transformation in the space. You all who have had a good electrodynamics course know how this works. You may recall the two-dimensional problems in electrostatics can also be solved by conformal transformations, and they mean, in effect, that any problem involving a configuration of charges in one region, one kind of region, can be mapped into the whole two-dimensional plane and gives you a solution of a problem in electrostatics in that whole two-dimensional plane. Okay, there is one more symmetry that has interesting stuff to it, which Polyakov, as a scholar of symmetries, knew about. The point at infinity is, to some extent, special in a complex variable theory. To make it non-special, to make it like any other point, you must demand that a transformation which doesn't have any other singularities but takes the point at zero into infinity and the point at infinity into zero produces a invariance. That kind of transformation is R goes into R, vector R divided by R squared, or z goes into 1 over z is equivalent. Polyakov then pointed out that the transformation corresponding to this would be O alpha of R going into R to the minus 2x alpha times O alpha of R over R squared. This so-called conformal boost operation produces significant extra limitations upon the form of correlation functions. In particular, there is no reason why in the strict symmetries, why two operators with different critical indices, the symmetries of rotation, scale invariance, and translation, there is no reason why two operators with different critical indices should not have a correlation function. The correlation function, for example, for energy density magnetization would be represented that way, with B being a constant. If you apply conformal invariance to a structure with like the two-point function, you soon learn that the H values have to be the same for the two-point function, correlation function between two operators, to be non-zero. Therefore, we learn that B is equal to zero on line three of this slide. This is a important consequence and was first pointed out by Polyakov. In fact, Polyakov pointed out the conformal symmetry gives a tremendous amount of information about the structure of critical point correlation functions. I'll just list a few of results. You have to understand what the context is. There are guys like me working in the trenches, doing hideous calculations, calculating all kinds of fancy correlation functions. And then there are guys like Polyakov, who say, aha, I know a symmetry. That symmetry will produce some answer or another. And in what looks like something that he does in 5 minutes, he has produced a result equivalent to 6 months of work the hard way. Here are some of his results. At the critical point, any one of these operators has expectation value zero. The two-point function, as I've said before, requires that the H values for the two operators be the same. The endpoint function, okay, the three-point function is uniquely determined by conformal symmetry considerations, not uniquely determined by scaling. And in fact, the endpoint function, we know how it behaves. The combination of z values listed here, z1 minus z2, z3 minus z4, divided by z1 minus z3, z2 minus z4, that combination of z values is invariant under conformal transformations. You get factors of derivatives like dw dz at point z1 in the numerator. You get such a factor in the denominator as well. That kind of correlation is invariant under conformal transformations. That means any endpoint function can depend only on combinations of z's like this. We already know that the distortions of our planar system will produce interesting changes in correlation functions. The coordinate system in question is of the form, or the coordinate transformation in question is of the form r goes into r prime, where r prime, start out thinking about infinitesimal transformations, r prime is r plus eta, where eta is infinitesimal and might depend on position r. We can build up all the finite changes we would like from infinitesimal ones, except for inversions, which can be generated from the special from special transformations of the form r prime is 1 over r, or z prime is 1 over z. We can then use those special transformations to build a version of the conformal transformation, z prime is 1 over z plus a. This is an inversion followed by an infinitesimal translation followed by an inversion. We don't expect our correlation functions to be invariant under shearing operations. That is, if we pull out this way, if we increase the x coordinate and decrease the y coordinate at the same time and do that at any point in space, this is a shearing operation, and we don't expect invariance under that. However, we expect invariance under any kind of transformation in which we have a holomorphic or anti-holomorphic transformation, any kind of transformation like that except at points of singularity. As a consequence, well, I've said that already, the no-shear requirement is precisely the same as the requirement of conformal transformations. And now I'm going to represent it not in terms of R, but I'm going to talk about Z prime and Z plus eta of Z is the kind of transformation we're going to do. Okay, we've been talking about two kinds of transformations. There's the global conformal group. That group has in it three basic elements: translations, rotations and scale transformations, and conformal z goes into 1 over z transformation. These transformations are global analytic transformations of the complex plane. All other transformations have singularity someplace. This group of operations transforms a function of the form az plus b divided by cz plus d into itself. We can think of it as performing operation on this matrix, and you'll learn how to do that. Another equally good way of thinking about these complex analytic transformations is to think about the infinitesimal versions of these transformations. These are generated by the operators, first of all, in the holomorphic section, in which we have a dz, but we multiply it by z to some power. These operators have a commutation relation, commutator of Ln, that's the power of z, with Lm, is proportional to n minus n to L times L to the n plus m. The algebra of this algebra is closed, that is, it generates nothing beyond itself. If we allow all integer values of n, positive and negative integer values, or if we allow only n equals 0, minus 1, and 1. 0, minus 1, and 1 is the global conformal transformations. The other values of n describe things which have to do with functions that are analytic someplace and not analytic in other places.
As an infinitesimal transformation.
I have it. Let me go back a slide. One more. Back. Oh. I'll tell you, and then we can talk about the algebra for a second. I do three operations. Take the draw. The conformal boost followed by an infinitesimal transformation followed by a conformal boost. Two boosts. The second boost undoes the first boost. The conformal boost is z goes into 1 over z. Then we do z goes into z plus a, but a is infinitesimal, so I'll write it as a. And then I will do again z goes into 1 over z. If you go through these successively and expand in a power series in eta, you find that the transformation is z goes into z plus or minus, I've forgotten which, eta times z squared. So this operation with the z squared is equivalent to putting this conformal boost into the pot, but stick with infinitesimal transformations. I never learned group theory properly, but you got a problem when you have groups with elements that are different in that they have no infinitesimal version. You want to talk about infinitesimal transformations, you have to talk about what this 1 over z operation can do without looking at it itself. And this goes by the name of the special conformal transformation. It was on one of the slides, but it's this.
So we talk about this in two dimensions. I don't know very much about these kinds of symmetries, but I don't see any reason why it shouldn't work in three. Like, does it break, or does it just become much more complicated and we don't like to talk about it?
Okay. Zillions of people have tried to extend this to three dimensions. Now, let me talk about what you can do with complex variables. You can do compositions. First I do the transformation H and then I do the transformation G. And that works perfectly lovely with complex variables. Then I replace Z by something which has three coordinates. One way of doing that is in three dimensions to use the quaternions called IJK, which we know better as sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3, the Pauli spin matrices. And then you try to do something like this. Well, first of all, it's hard to define a function of A, B, C times these things because these things don't commute with each other. Z commutes with Z, or any function of Z, whereas these guys don't commute. The natural thing to do in four dimensions is add to these guys the unit unit matrix, and it's still the same problem. Complex variables are unique and different. And although one can define the analog of the conformal group, that is, translations, rotation, scale changes, and the conformal boost in, say, three dimensions, you can't do the rest of it with analytic function theory. And the rest of it, it gives us the opportunity to talk about distortions in the plane, correlations in any fancy region of space, and indeed gives us appropriate form for commutation relations. The basic change operators are Ln and Lm within the complex plane, and we just said that they have a commutation relation which is of this form. If you try to do the analogous thing for three dimensions, the corresponding changes get much, much hairier and can't be done in such a neat form, and then you lose contact with everything. So the answer to your question is, we know just how to express the geometry of the plane in terms of algebra, and we have no good way of doing that beyond two dimensions, much to lots of people's chagrin. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about how we actually perform the changes that are represented by distortions in the plane. Practically none of you have taken courses in elasticity. How many people have taken a course which included elasticity? Yeah, one. Hey, that's a lot. Okay. As you recall, elasticity is represented by stresses and strains. Stress is how you push on the thing or pull on it, and the strain is how it responds. In fact, what is called a stress tensor occurs in statistical mechanics. The dynamics, the Hamiltonian dynamics, gives you conservation law for momentum. That conservation for momentum, momentum is a vector, the conservation law for momentum has as part of it a current, that's a local flow of momentum, which is called a stress tensor. It is represented by TJK. It is the jth component of the momentum current, defined by the direction moving in the momentum moving in direction K. The momentum is conserved, so the TJK has divergence zero. That is, we're going back to our old description of conservation laws, and in that old description of conservation laws, we have a conserved quantity, rho. Here, the conserved quantity is not rho, but g, the momentum density, plus a current. The divergence of a current equals zero. The current, in this case, is the stress tensor, and there it is on the top of this slide. The momentum is conserved, so that the stress tensor has divergence zero. With a little fussing, one can make it symmetrical in its two indices, so that TJK is equal to TKJ. The momentum acts like a spatial gradient. Its current T is important because it induces transformations in the plane.
the structure of the plane and its deformation defines and describes all the usual models of critical phenomena. In fact, the stress tensor is doubly important. Its correlations with all the basic operators in the theory describe how they fit into the space, and its and the correlation function of stress tensors with stress tensors describe how the space responds to things acting on it. You may remember that general relativity, which is all about the structure of space, also involves in an essential role a stress tensor. For a study of mechanics or field theory, we learn that the effect of stressing a system is studied by adding to its Hamiltonian, or free energy functional, a term of the form Hamiltonian divided by T. It goes into Hamiltonian divided by T, is Boltzmann constant times temperature, minus 1 over 2 pi times the sum over all the positions of the thing, times the stress tensor at point R, JK component, times the derivative of the distortion, infinitesimal distortion, eta k, at point R, the jth derivative of eta k times tjk. So eta of R is an infinitesimal displacement of the coordinate on R. This change then produces a small distortion of the system. The stress tensor is itself, at the critical point, a traceless tensor. Exactly why it's traceless, I don't understand. there's something deep going on there, which I don't understand. But you'll have to accept this idea that it's a traceless tensor, so that T11 is minus T22, and it's symmetric. T12 is equal to T21. It can be split into two parts in a natural way for complex variable theory as T sub Z is 2T11 plus IT12, and with Z star is the same thing with a minus I. We're going to calculate, or at least we're going to write down, the change induced by this variation of the Hamiltonian upon, I'm watching the clock because I have a limo picking me up. We're going to calculate the change in the stress tensor, induced the change in the correlation function of a bunch of operators, induced by this change in the Hamiltonian, that is, by a distortion of the system. That's what conformal invariance theory is all about. If you go to the Isaac model, you can form these stress tensors by multiplying neighboring sigma variables and looking for things that have the invariance properties of second-order tensors, at least in the continuum limit. These tensors that you form this way, T11 and T12, have the effect of distorting the system by pulling it in one direction and compressing it in another. So it gets expanded this way and compressed that way. I said something in the shears, which are is incompatible with what I'm saying now. I'm not going to get a chance to fix it up. But what I'm saying here is correct. What I said back there on the slide is correct also. Namely, do not talk about shears as invariances in a critical phenomena. The effect of the T11 summed over all space is to enhance the R1 coordinate and to shrink the 2 coordinate in equal measure. It's represented by this differential operator. T12 has a similar effect at 45 degrees to this. We can then decompose the stress tension, there should be a small t, into two components, small t zz and small t z star, which was the small t sub z and the small t sub z star represented in the last slide. The divergenceless condition is the condition that the derivative with respect to T star of TZZ equals 0 and the derivative with respect to z of z star is equal to 0, so that, for example, tzz is some function of z alone and not of the other coordinate z star. They have the effect that this t does the derivative with respect to z and the derivative with respect to y on the correlation function, and this other t star does the derivative with respect to z star and y star with coefficients z and y here, coefficients z star and y star there. That's what the stress does. Now I want to tell you that the stress tensor and is an eigenvalue operator. Imagine that I take the stress tensor, sum over all z, and apply it to an endpoint correlation function. Through an argument which is given here, which basically is, what does this thing do? It produces scale changes. It produces things like z d by dz on all of the coordinates. Well, if we have a z d by dz on all of the coordinates, what that is equivalent to a multiplication by the sum of the h's represented by the different operators there. Therefore, the effect of the sum over all positions of t of z is the production of an eigenvalue operation on a correlation function. We're in business now. That is, we should recognize that we have potentially an algebra of commutation relations, of commutation relations among the operators that make up t. That we have t producing an eigenvalue relation from the correlation functions. Now we pick up, we think a little bit, or we imagine picking up our copy of my favorite quantum mechanics book, Dirac's Quantum Mechanics. As you recall, Dirac solved the harmonic oscillator problem by doing commutation relations and talking about the commutation relations of the various operators here, A and A adjoint, which go into the harmonic oscillator problem. By talking about commutation relations and nothing but commutation relations, he was able to derive the eigenvalues and a lot about the wave functions for the harmonic oscillator. Similarly here, we have a slightly extended form of this commutation relation, which is going to be written down probably on one of the next slides. We have the fact that these basic operators are, in fact, producers of eigenvalues. We could then expect to get, from the study of this algebra, a understanding of the eigenvalues in the system, in the problem, and from an understanding of the eigenvalues, an understanding of almost the entire problem.
I'm looking at correlation functions as eigenfunctions, and they're what happens when they get stressed as a chain which is a multiplication of eigenvalues. Just as one looks at eigenfunctions, wave functions, in quantum mechanics, and what happens when they get changed in time as a production of an eigenvalue called the energy in quantum mechanics. This is essentially identical. There are two directions, neither of which we call time, but in some theories you might take one of those directions and call it a time. You're now talking about eigenvalues as you change the size of coordinates, and you're generating something which is conceptually very closely akin to standard quantum mechanics. That's what's going to happen. That's the analysis of Polyakov and co-workers. So here it is, as stated, as put it together. Now imagine that we wish to calculate the effect of this kind of distortion on a correlation function of operators at the point z in a certain compact bounded region of the complex plane, with eta of z being analytic in that region. Looks like I'm getting fancy. I must have copied it out of a book. We're in the continuum limit, so the sums over lattice points can be replaced by integrals. Stokes' law, which is the relationship between boundary integrals and area integrals, gives us the result that h over t goes into h over t times the integral dz over a boundary of the interval around which the z's up there sit, of t of z times eta of z. Stokes' law then took away one derivative from eta. That's what it does. And there's a minus sign and a 1 over 2 pi I z star t star of z star times eta star of z star. And I can't remember whether the two paths of integration go in opposite directions or the same, but that's okay because I'm only going to work with z. It says here that they go around the same sense. We now have a change in the correlation function in which the effect of eta is to take the integral around a path around all of these points of eta of z times a correlation of t of z with all of those guys. But we already know a lot about the correlations of t of z, and we will know more if we recognize that we have what are called short distance expansions. At least I call them short distance expansions. They were what happens when z gets close to w. Other people have called them operator product expansions, since apparently the short distance isn't needed if you include enough terms. It's true for all distances. So t times o is some, here are the first few terms in it. It's the eigenvalue h, that is the scaling index h, times z minus w to the minus 2 times o, plus a term in z minus w to the minus 1 times the derivative of o. This they get by doing deep studies of the field theory involved. And then you can change the, you can describe the changes in correlations of the basic operators. I'm coming to the end of what I want to say. Let me look forward a little bit. Yes. I'm not going to fill in the details for you. Some of the details are in the lecture notes. Other details are in the references. Other details, the same details, will be in Jamie Gomez's course starting a week from Monday. What happens next is that one takes the operator T and does a sort of expansion in it around points in the complex plane. Here's an expansion. It is, I think it says there, equivalent to a Fourier transform expansion of T. In any case, from T, one defines a set of operators, capital L sub n of W. Those L sub n's of W are like these Ln's defined here, in which I had z to the n d by dz, except that it isn't just a change in z. It includes all of the structural changes produced by the stress tensor T. And so that this capital L is different from that small L. And the commutation relation is a little different. Capital L's have a commutation relation, like this commutation relation, except that there's an extra term, C, in it. This term is exactly the same as what's on the board. This extra term, with C times delta N times minus M, times a constant,
defines what is called the conformal charge, C. Different problems in two-dimensional statistical mechanics have different values of the conformal charge. For example, the XY model has C equal to 1. The two-dimensional Isaac model has C equals 1/2, and so forth. On a good day, I could give you a much longer list of C values. I'm not going to do so. This extra term is important in describing what makes the different statistical mechanics problems in two dimensions different. This thing is called the conformal charge. This whole commutation relation is called the Virasoro algebra and describes the basic structure of two-dimensional space as seen by critical phenomena theory. Together with the algebraic relations describing the relationship between T and the O's, this gives you enough information to, in fact, define everything, to do the calculation analogous to Dirac's harmonic oscillator calculation, and find every one of the eigenvalues for every fluctuating operator for a whole class of problems in two dimensions.
What do I call it?
Conformal charge.
Thank you. Starting to make more mistakes than I should. It's almost time to go. Thank you. Okay. You will be able to read more about this in Carty's book, which does it in the simplest way. This book, which does it in the least simple possible way, this book, which is intermediate and is pretty good, here are the original references, Polyakov's first time through the full definition of the theory, and the calculation which enabled us to see what every one of the most important, what the properties of the most important properties what the properties of the most important problems in two dimensions would be. Going forward from this point, we can calculate essentially the structure of essentially all the correlation functions that are most important for the properties of the critical point of all of these two-dimensional problems. We only know a little bit about the behavior away from criticality. Apply a little bit of magnetic field to the Isaac model, and all of this collapses. We know hardly anything at all about three dimensions. We know a little bit about four dimensions, but four-dimensional problems have a richness well beyond this. I am going to stop here. I'll be happy to take questions about this or any other portion of the course. Yes, please.
On the first slide, you talked about operators that have puncturing your two-dimensional lattice. I don't quite see what that means. So if you could just say what you meant by that.
What I'm about to tell you, I think, as far as I know, has not been fully worked out, but it is likely to be worked out in the not-too-distant future. Let me take... I think I'm answering your question. Let me take a correlation function between a sigma at R and a sigma at S. This is represented by a z, which might be an r coordinate, a u, which might be that s coordinate, raised to the 1n power and then a z star minus u star also to the 1/8. I drew this little line here. That's because I know that there are singularities only at these points. And I imagine a process in which I go calculate the analytic functions and go starting here and come around. Now, when I come around for an analytic function and the thing's perfectly analytic there, I can go past this line or any line I draw. However, when I go past this line, I come back to not the same function, but a different function. In fact, one comes back to a function which might be I times the function one started with, or might be minus the function one started with, or something which is slightly different. The structure of the space is one in which one has sort of sheets piled on top of one another. And those sheets are called Riemann sheets, and they reflect the deepest properties of complex variable theory. This is a so-called integrable problem in two-dimensional science. Integrable problems are mostly representable in terms of complex variable theory, and they often can be described, among other ways of describing them, in terms of the deepest properties of analytic functions. At least I think they can be described in terms of the deepest properties of analytic functions. This is how I guess the field is going to advance in the next bunch of years. So far, it has only advanced infinitesimal steps in that direction. My recollection is the part of mathematics which talks about what happens when you go around singularities. It's called monodromy theory, and it gives us an understanding of what goes on in connections among Riemann sheets piled on top of one another because of analytic function theory. As you can tell from my pronunciation of monodromy, I didn't learn this stuff in school, and most physicists haven't learned this stuff in school. And most mathematicians haven't learned about complex variable theory, about the critical phenomena. However, people are sort of getting together, and I think this is the direction it's going to go. In any case, that's sort of what I meant by when I said the structure of the space is going to be what is analyzed in the next bunch of years, and is going to lie at the deep basis of this critical phenomena theory. Now, what I have just said takes into account in no way, shape, or form the behavior near the critical point. And the behavior near the critical point has got to be important too, and has got to be incorporated into the same kind of thinking. So the right thing to say is, I have some guess about where one particular piece of the theory is going to go. I have no guesses about where the theory as a whole will go, because my guess about the critical point doesn't help me much. However, I do know that this is a deep problem in partially in physics, but also in the physics of integral systems and in mathematics, and is likely to attract the attention of people over the next bunch of years. So I do believe the structure of the space is important. I can't cross T's and dot I's for you. That you're going to have to do for yourself, maybe. Further questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, one and all. Have a great holiday.